Blog Talk Radio.
Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, toward chesed, instructions of kindness, toward rachamim, instructions of mercies. You're now tuned into the higher inner frequency of Soul Class. And here it comes, Soul Class number 516, in the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio, Secular by Design, program presentation number 46. Blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live on October 13, 2015, corresponding to the 30th day of Tishrei, 5,776 years since our common ancestors Adam and Eve walked upon this blessed earth. Our program content will focus on reading from Alan W. Cecil's seminal work, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, which can be purchased via the following link at Amazon.com. You just type in Secular Design, Philosophy, Noahide Observances. And I want to read you a comment from a Dr. Pesach H. Goodley, who read Alan's book. In fact, we have Alan online. We'll bring him on in a second. Which he describes Alan's seminal work as a brilliant, in fact, unique book that gives no quarter to atheists and the like. Alan Cecil immediately distinguishes intelligence from intellectual, Jewish teachings about the origins from Christian, quote-unquote, religious beliefs based strictly on their, quote-unquote, New Testament, but erroneously attributed to the Bible, quote-unquote, therefore falsely to Jewish belief. Its only real problem is that it takes intelligence to read it and the courage to read it, willing to adjust oneself to the real reality, by Pesach H. Goodley, MD, and it's now 9:34 Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unifying Souls. Actually, our call-in number to listen or share your views for the next 25 minutes is at 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones peaceful and pleasantly, and live online with me. Right now, with such a pleasant surprise, the one and only, da-da-da-da-da, here's Alan!
Shalom Lechem, Rabbi Goodman. Yes, I just gave you an instant promotion. Congratulations.
Well, Alan, you can call me anything you like, but just don't call me late for dinner. I've heard about this Southern hospitality, and I won't pass it up.
There you go.
Alan, before we go into the book, I want to tell you something. Everything, you know, I'm sure you're adhering to this. There's nothing by chance. Everything's by Ashkacha Pratis. Do you know, lo and behold, I heard an interview with one of the people you write about in your book, Professor Richard Dawkins, yesterday on New York City Radio. And I'd like to tell you what he said, and I'd like to hear your comment on this. Well, Professor Dawkins is very sure of the science of statistical probability, and he was criticizing the authenticity of the assertions of 523, I guess if that's the number correct, 553 representatives in the United States Congress and Senate who all proclaim to have some sort of faith. And Professor Dawkins, using his scientifically gauged mind, said that the statistical probability of that occurring is highly unlikely, and therefore accused these politicians of lying, concerns of whether they assert to be Christians or Muslims or Jews. And if I recall, I took a course, Alan, in statistics many, many moons ago when I was 18 years old, and there is a paradigm called the bell curve, where most of the statistical data that a person can gather is within the shape of a bell, and that which is beyond the outer regions of that bell is, you know, not considered to be of statistical occurrence. It could happen, you know. But yet, Dr. Dawkins professes to say it's highly unlikely, without personally doing the scientific research of interacting with each politician to see, in fact, if their views are just, in fact, for political reasons, or in fact, they are authentically, you know, religious, whether they be Jews or Christians or Muslims or any other faith. So, Alan, I see here there's a certain sterility to this type of reasoning, which makes it clearly understood why someone like Dr. Dawkins, who you so accurately portray in your book as someone who is not interested in finding the truth, which science promotes itself as a pursuer of truth, but rather a means of advancing their own personal agenda, whatever it may be. Your comments on this matter.
Yeah, the bell curve is so 20th century. Right now, most of your secular atheists who are attacking Judaism and other religions are their big thing is Bayes probability theory, BAYES. That's what they're really into. And again, you know, it's a probability. It's used by a lot of companies, you know, for marketing and such. But they're trying to use that against what the Bible, you know, what the Tanakh teaches. And I don't know. You know, probability doesn't really give you any answers. In a very narrow range, it can tell you, you know, if certain people interact to do such and such, this would probably happen. And that's about as well as they can do. As you know, since you've read the book, I'm not a really big fan of Dr. Dawkins, to say the least. And I don't know. I've said this before on the show. The main focus of his attack is Christianity and Christian theology, which right. I understand. But in attacking that, he also attacks the Torah, even though it is so painfully obvious he doesn't know anything about it. He thinks that Judaism is just Christianity minus Jesus. That's the way he looks at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Let's now go further into the book. Oh, but I just want to mention that he also mentioned that he wrote a book several years ago about seeing the advantage of the symbiotic relation between the sciences and the arts, like through poetry, which, you know, that's a nice way of using the tool of science, you know, writing prose about a test tube and soliloquies about, you know, binary theory and out and out, you know, write a play about quantum physics. Hey,
yeah, because there's absolutely no poetry in the Tanakh, right?
And Lamentations certainly is not singing the blues. It's the prophecy of the Jews.
cute.
Okay, let's now go into your book, Alan, page 90, Secular by Design, the section called Protocols of the Philosopher. We read this last time, but it's actually we haven't been together since the beginning of September. So I think it's important for our listening audience out there to hear this section as we segue into further sections of the book. As we have seen, John Selden's work on the Noahide Law lost favor as the Industrial Age began, and one can only wonder how different British and American society would have been had Selden's teaching been heeded. There is no telling what the world might have looked like if the two mightiest Western empires of the past three centuries, British and American, had adopted the Noahide Law as the basis for both civil and international law, or at least incorporated into their legal systems. Yet the most these two nations accomplished was to tweak the laws enough where the Jews did not have to live in constant worry that their houses would be burned down over their heads, their women raped, and their children bayoneted, as the Western Europeans had been doing for centuries. As America and then Britain passed laws that enabled the Jews to live in society almost as equals, we patted ourselves on the back and beamed with pride at our new constitution and laws, thinking ourselves as a sublime example of humanity and reason. Besides, there were other races of men to exploit and humiliate and humble, men with brown skin and red skin. The Jews we could tolerate as long as they behaved themselves and contributed to the economy. I just want to focus on this, your assertion and, I guess, heartfelt feeling that, you know, if it only had been that American and British society had integrated the Noahide laws, the teachings as far as the basis for civil and international law, for certainly the outlook of this land, the United States of America, the North American continent, would have a different outlook. Because, you know, I've been listening to, there's a wonderful host, he's a Mohawk American Native Indian by the name of John Cain, who is trying to take the consciousness of many human beings to task by saying, you know, you have to realize, people, we as the Native Indigenous peoples of this country never surrendered to the American Republic or the Western philosophical outlook, which is basically the doctrine of discovery rooted in the teachings of the Vatican. Yet, on the other hand, from the other side of the coin, from the American British Aesovic Adamic perspective, they, after practicing on us, I guess we were the target practice, we the Jews and even Christians were, at one point, were targeted as well. So they figured if it was successful in Europe, they could humble and destroy the civilization of the Native American Indian and rape the women and kill the men. And recently I learned that this whole concept of red skin was based on not on the fact that American Indians have red skin, but it was based after their skin was literally torn off them by the Europeans. Well, when you go beyond the epidermis and the layers of skin, whatever they're called, the skin is red. So I was horrified to learn that. And so, again, we were the target practice, but if these matters of international application of the Noahide laws were placed upon this continent, we would have a much more symbiotic relationship with the indigenous people of this land.
Well, I agree, and it's just, you know, I don't want to go into the ifs and what could have been, because all that is conjecture, but obviously right. Our legal system and government would be vastly different than what it is today, and the way we've treated other people. As I pointed out in the book, I've mentioned it, I go into it more later, but we are an Aesovian society. You know, we take after Greece and Rome, and our goal is to subjugate everyone else. So that's how we approach it. Instead of following the lead of Israel and trying to get along with everybody, we're trying to subjugate them.
Sure. So let's go further into what we didn't read yet on this program presentation and our humble efforts. In page 91 of your book, Alan, yet how reasonable is it to ignore a dissenting view, to disregard an entire school of learning and reason in lieu of its obvious relevance to Western thought? It is one thing to disagree with a particular view, but to dismiss it outright without looking at the evidence displays unreason. It was not that the Noahide Law was unknown to 17th century scholars, quite the contrary. However, something else was at work, an underlying malaise that influenced the Enlightenment philosophers to ridicule, demean, and ignore the Torah. Even when the Torah was examined, with very few exceptions, the writing of the sages and the responses from rabbis of the day was traced to the Gentile Enlightenment scholars. Now, Alan, I just want to mention, when you use the word treif, I've been learning the laws of shechita, ritual slaughter, how we kill kosher animals before we consume the meat. And treif is a very, very interesting term that you picked up, because treif means, that is a term that was used by the sages, and that is indicative of something which has been wounded and is going to die. So the Enlightenment philosophers had the expectation, the deterministic expectation, that the teachings from the rabbis and the sages and the prophets, all the way going back to the five books of Moses, would literally die or fade away from human consciousness. And lo and behold, here we are. Is there such a thing as an Enlightenment movement today, Alan? I don't think so.
Well, we're still in the Enlightenment era, so to speak. You know, if there's any paragraph in my book that I would like Richard Dawkins to read, it's the one you're reading right now.
Because this conversation is an ongoing one. It hasn't ended.
Yeah. It's I don't know. People think they're open-minded because they are either conservative or liberal or Republican. They're trying to look at both sides of the issue, not understanding that our whole culture and society is very one-sided. You know, it's all based on the Greek and Roman. You know, there's maybe a little bit of this and that tossed in, but mostly our foundation is a Greek-Roman culture, and very few people look outside of that. Now, Jews are just naturally trained to do that because, you know, especially in the Galus, they are in a different culture, and they're used to, you know, they understand the Torah point of view, and then they also understand the point of view from whatever culture they're residing in.
Right. We do try to be integrative. I mean, there are aspects of our, you know, there's cultures and subcultures within the Jewish nation right now, whether observant or non-observant. But generally speaking, I would say the overall view, with the exception of a few, is the term radical? I don't know if that's the right, or just extreme, I'm not trying to insult anyone, but generally speaking, we believe in being integrative, because after all, God integrated us into his creation, so that's an instruction that we should be integrated with the rest of creation. Now, going further into this chapter, or this page, I should say, at the end of this second paragraph in page 91, from the Noahide perspective, this utter failure to accept anything Torah-related represented a step backward for Western culture, not a step forward, substituting a system of hedonistic Greek paganism for the system of theological paganism of the church and the flame that Grotius and Selden had lit in Western Europe was snuffed out by Greek-loving intellectuals and philosophers of the Enlightenment. I guess the old saying, Alan, is you are what you eat. Maybe they ate too much Greek food, therefore they came to love the intellect as well as the Greek salad. I don't know. Well, I'm trying to be a little humorous here.
Continue.
I had a good cup of coffee this morning. Going further, the protocols of the Enlightenment philosophers resulted in the development of systems of reason and logic that were neither based on Torah nor on rabbinic logic. As elaborate as these systems of philosophy were, they were ultimately used to justify any behavior, no matter how hedonistic, from the killing of unwanted babies to political ideologies such as Nazism. The philosophical secularization and polarization of religious morality and legalism were used to justify moral and ethical behavior which was against the teachings of Torah. And this is, as you point out here now in this footnote by Hannah Arendt, Responsibility and Judgment, Jerome Cohen, New York, Shocking Books, 2003, pages 67-68. Kant, with the consistency of thought which is the mark of a great philosopher, therefore puts the duties of man has to himself ahead of duties to others. The standard is neither the love of some neighbor, nor self-love, nor self-respect. Moral conduct has nothing to do with obedience to any law that is given from the outside, be it the law of God and the laws of men. Alan, that sounds a little bit narcissistic. What do you think?
Yeah, she was a very well-known 20th century philosopher. She was a secular Jew, as a matter of fact. But again, you know, anyone who disregards, you know, they get into the Western philosophies, the Western teachings, they either ignore or totally ignorant of the Jewish teachings, you know, the halakha, the philosophy. And, you know, this is the sort of thing they push. And especially when you have secular Jews like Ken Hart and people like Noam Chomsky, you know, oh, they're Jewish, you know. No, well, I mean, yeah, they're Jewish physically, but spiritually and intellectually, no. What they're teaching is the same old Western philosophical Greek-Roman viewpoint.
I look at people like that, Alan, of the Jewish people as post-traumatic destruction of Second Temple syndrome, meaning after 1,900 plus years since the destruction of the temple and dispersion of the people from the last period of time we had our own, so to speak, commonwealth, even after there was the cessation of Jewish kings and prophets, that it just, you know, people become self-flagellating and saying, I must have done something wrong if we're in such a situation like this. So therefore, those who claim we're doing wrong, we should validate their feelings. So when I think of someone like Noam Chomsky, or as I never heard of this woman before I read your book, I'm just saying that it's a kind of like a self, that there must be something wrong of us if so many people are saying we're bad or wrong or this and that, or killers of this person or killers of that person. When, you know, that's just my two cents. There's nothing, I'm not trying to lay down the law. It's just my own opinion. I see for myself, from being now 30 years, thank God, engaged in Judaic lifestyle, how much I was self-flagellating towards myself and guilt, feelings of guilt, until I realized the true, in a microcosmic slice of my consciousness, I feel guilty if I'm not trying to do better in this world. Aside from that, I cannot assume guilt of myself because of what transpired 2,000 years ago, what happened 3,000 years ago, because I wasn't there. I don't recall my previous lifetimes, for those of us who believe in these things. Anyway, we now turn, as we go further into your book, we now turn to those anti-Semitic memes, which you defined in the beginning of your book on page 35 as, and that's meme, M-E-M-E, is defined as an entity that is capable of being transmitted from one brain to another. So we now turn to these anti-Semitic memes that were passed from their classical and theological hosts, incubated in the minds of the philosophers, and then infected other academic scholars, such as historians. I'd also like to mention that I saw yesterday, it was a Jeremy Wright, who was the pastor, who used to be the pastor of President Obama, promoted the idea, it's been reported, that he used to teach that Yeshua, or Jesus, as the Christians would call him in the West, was actually a Palestinian. Now, that would be historically incorrect, Alan, because Palestine was actually a term that was named after the Romans had fully conquered Israel. It used to be called Judea, and there was in the lower southern western strip of Israel, that's where the Philistines used to live. Palestine was something which came about 100 plus years after the destruction of the Second Temple, yet Reverend Wright was calling Jesus or Yeshua a Palestinian. So it's I'm saying someone like him, even on the philosophical or theological religious level, is somehow been affected by these type of revisionists or enlightenists, or people like to darken the issues. Any maybe you'd like to give an example of how these ideas just filter down continually to society. People may say such distorted expressions that they don't even realize where they're coming from in terms of how they've been influenced by these outside influences, historically speaking.
Well, look at Western art. Look at paintings of Jesus as a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Anglo-Saxon or an Italian. I mean, it's not just calling him, oh, he was a Palestinian. I mean, unless you want to talk about the real Palestinians, the original Palestinians, which was Israel.
Right.
The Romans after they crushed Bar Kokhba, named the land Philistine as an insult to the Jews. I mean, they did. It was a deliberate name change. I don't know. It just boggles the mind how people can believe this sort of thing. But you know, this is the sort of thing that we have to deal with. And, you know, as I was pointing out, you know, what you just read, here is an entire branch of learning that has been ignored. And that whole chapter, the whole part about John Selden to me is just one of the most remarkable examples of blinders that Western academics have used. I mean, this was a guy who was looked at by his peers as the greatest mind in Britain at the time, especially legal.
Wow.
And they just ignored his teachings. They deliberately pushed it out of any kind of discourse, and very few people know about him.
Yeah, true. And God bless you for bringing this historical figure to light. Hopefully more people do more research about him, and hopefully that his name will become, and his consciousness will be resurrected into the minds of more and more human beings to learn more about really what transpired in the last 300 years in Western Europe and here in the Americas. Moving on quickly to page 93 in chapter 2 of your book, Alan, which you subtitled Protocols of the Historian. We're going to be quoting now from Edgar Hallett Cart, What is History?, printed in 1961 in New York by Vintage Books, page 9. It used to be said that facts speak for themselves. This is, of course, untrue. The facts speak only when the historian calls on them. It is he who decides on which facts to give the floor and which order or context. It is the historian who has decided for his own reasons that Caesar's crossings of that petty stream, the Rubicon, is a fact of history, whereas the crossing of the Rubicon by millions of other people before or since interests nobody at all. I find that quite humorous, Alan. And you know, one of the things I love about learning about Jewish history is there's not just one source. You can go into thousands and thousands of books because everyone has a different perspective. And again, from a Torah perspective, from a written and oral Torah, healthy, conscious perspective, is try to learn as many perspectives as possible. Talk it over with your friends. What you accept, you can accept. What you can't accept, then you have to figure out what's bothering you about what you don't accept, as opposed to this narrowing of consciousness under the context of true history. I'd like to give an example as it has a contemporary application. I just heard this morning on National Public Radio, Alan, that in 2007, there were 26 debates amongst the candidates running for the Democratic nomination for president. Of course, we know President Obama won. It was just announced that there will only be 6 debates between now and before the 2016 November presidential elections. And but the Democratic National Committee is now not allowing certain people who would like to become candidates for the presidency on the Democratic Party ticket, that if they speak outside of those 6 political debates, they are no longer qualified to enter one of those 6 political debates. So here we see here that even in contemporary history, in terms of getting a dialogue, of trying to understand what a candidate, I'm not trying to emphasize the political implications, but rather when there's such a closed-mindedness, and especially when the party is called Democratic, I mean, it seems to me they're undoing the very name. They're taking out the soul of the word Democratic by saying we can only have 6 debates, and whoever speaks outside of the debates in public media will be barred from participating in those debates, even if he or she is a viable candidate for the Democratic nomination for the President of the United States. I mean, Alan, so we see that just in contemporary society, there's a narrowing down of consciousness or dialogue. In Jewish culture, and also a healthy, I would also propose in a healthy B'nai Noach culture, dialogue is of the essence to distill from it a practical implementation of how to improve society. Your take on this?
The old joke about 2 rabbis, 3 opinions. Here it's 2 politicians, 1 opinion. I remember the same thing happened back in 2000 when they had the candidates debate, and they kept Ralph Nader from participating. And the reason they did was he had some views that were very anti-corporate, which, you know, of course, didn't please the corporate sponsors of the debate very much. So, you know, because on that basis, he was pretty much kept out of it. I also want to point out, you know, we are starting a new chapter in the book. This is chapter 2, which is on history and the historians. You know, previously we've been for the last few months we've been talking about the philosophers, and this leads into the way I did the book. The philosophers influenced our outlook on history. When we start writing history, especially for the modern Western history, to me, the main source, I like to go back to Edward Gibbon in his huge work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, that he wrote back, I think it was published during the American Revolution, but it had such a huge, huge impact on Western thought. And that's one of the people I go into, you know, just his views of history in Rome. And, you know, again, here's a man, you know, in England, a British man who's glorifying Rome. And we'll get into some of the things he said about Israel and the Jews.
True. And with that being said, Alan, we've actually come to the end of the show, and I'd like to thank you profusely for coming on so spontaneously this morning. And hopefully next week at this time, from 9:30 a.m. to about 10 plus a.m. Let's see, today's the 13th. Hopefully on October 20th, we'll continue this discussion. And it's just something that I think as more and more people are going to be hearing these broadcasts, whether live or on the archive version, hopefully they will develop the thirst to purchase your book, to read it, and to form discussion groups, whether it be with us, to call up live, or to in their own communities. And again, there is nothing in your book, I would assert, that's telling anyone what to do as much as educate themselves to become properly aligned to views that if they are true Christians or true Jews or true Muslims, there should be nothing that's going to tell them to disintegrate their core values, but actually to enhance them. I'd like to any feedback on what I just said.
I want them to question their core views because some of the core views that they have, you know, may not be based on, you know, it might be based on propaganda, what they've heard all their lives. But, you know, if you look at it from a different angle, like, you know, there's so many people out there who, for example, who grew up in the church, and then when they hear about the rabbinic commentary, you know, what the rabbi, this is what the Torah is really talking about, they're just amazed. You know, it goes against what they know, a lot of their core values, but they, so many of them realize, well, this makes sense. You know, this has a feeling of truth to it.
But isn't it, Alan, that the Christian Messiah also at one point in the New Testament was called Rabbi?
Yeah. And he, a lot of the things he said came straight out of the oral law. You know, if you read the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Anything, Alan, before I sign off, I'm going to segue out of the program as I usually do with David Dome's music. Anything you'd like to share, one more nugget of kernel of wisdom with our listening audience, something to take from today's program and put a little more snap, crackle, pop into their step and to upgrade their conscience towards reevaluating where they stand in relation to their obligations, as whether as Jews or Noahides?
Question everything.
That sounds like
advice.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alan. Hopefully we will reunite next week at this time on October 20th, God willing, at 9:30 in the morning. Blessed souls, I just want to conclude by saying that your comments, questions, and concerns will always be welcome. I have a Facebook page, Donzusia Goodman. If you're listening to Blog Talk Radio, you can send a comment on the archive version of today's humble effort. And now we're going to help us get back home with David Dome, who's going to remind us that it's time we realize, instead of sharing fears, instead of shedding tears, instead of your fears, which is the name of this song, we can all get together in way of Ahavachad, one love, Gorlachad, one destiny, Kulana for all of us, Badarchinom, Darchi Shalom, in a pleasant and peaceful way. And just remember, blessed souls, you've got to do good. Why? Even though that might generate some agita and some anxiety and some ambivalence within you, but a teva tov lehetiv, it's the nature of the good to do good, and the Creator put you on this earth to make it a better place, because all 7 billion plus of us, can yubu, and we increase, we're meant to be merely stewards and humble servants of the Most High Creator, and be in fellowship and assistance one to the other, instead of your fears, David Dome. Take care, everyone.
Put it back together.